From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. On Monday, the Electoral College seals the presidential election of 2016 with its own vote. But debate over that vote and the Electoral College itself is wide open. Twice in the last five elections, including this time, the popular vote and the Electoral College vote have not lined up. Some are calling for electors to reconsider their commitments, some for a revamp of the whole system. This hour on Point, the presidency, the Electoral College, and American democracy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What should happen on Monday and beyond with the Electoral College? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Arlington, Virginia, is Kyle Chaney, politics reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you. Can you just take us through the mechanics of what happens Monday with the vote of the Electoral College? Do they gather? Do they send it in from all over the country? How exactly does it work? What's the mechanical operation?
Sure. Well, so the Electoral College, the members were actually certified earlier in the week, and they will gather actually in their own state capital. So it's really 51 meetings if you count the District of Columbia, where they will get together and cast the formal vote for president.
All right. And then it's done under the Constitution. Then it's done.
Sort of. I mean, the votes themselves will then get sent to Congress, which in a joint session early next year will decide whether they consider them valid and ratify the Electoral College vote. So there's still a few steps in the process, but this is really where the rubber meets the road and they will decide, does what happened on Election Day, is it reflected in the Electoral College vote as well?
We've got 306 electoral votes lined up for Donald Trump. We've got 232 lined up for Hillary Clinton. That seems very clear, but there's been a lot of conversation over the last month and more. You've got different groups asking for different things. Among them, you've got a group of Democrats saying they want an intelligence briefing on Russian involvement in the U.S. elections before they cast their votes. Are they going to get it?
Highly doubtful that would happen. It would be a remarkable, an unprecedented move here. But what's also equally remarkable is that these electors are actually using their positions to try to leverage something to suggest that they have a duty to investigate the results of the election, investigate other things about the candidates before they cast their votes. That's unprecedented as well.
Then there's something called the Hamilton electors. What's that?
So that is a group of mostly Democrats, one Republican elector from Texas, who are calling for Republicans to unite behind an alternative candidate to Donald Trump, not to support Hillary Clinton, but to support some more mainstream Republican that they feel would be a better choice for the country than Donald Trump.
On what basis? What's the meaning of Hamilton electors?
Hamilton is a reference to the fact that Alexander Hamilton sort of outlined the concept of the Electoral College and in their view intended it to be a deliberative body that could decide, vote their conscience, pick someone that they felt was qualified as opposed to just rubber stamping the popular vote.
Do electors have the legal freedom to change their vote? Can they be unbound?
It depends on where they are. Now, some people would argue, yes, everywhere. The Constitution requires it. But in 29 states, there are actually laws that on the books that would prevent that. Whether those laws are constitutional is that something that's being litigated right now and could be decided. But it's sort of a murky question at this point.
We've got a lot to look at in this hour about the Electoral College, how it works, how it's going to work on Monday, and what people are saying and thinking about this particular election. We've got one of those electors who is looking at a change of vote. In fact, a Republican who said he will not cast his electoral vote for Donald Trump. Christopher Suprin joins us. He's a Republican elector from Texas. He joins us right now from Dallas. Chris Suprin, thank you very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Why are you saying you're not going to cast your electoral vote for Mr. Trump?
Well, he fails subjectively two tests that Alexander Hamilton laid out for us in Fearless 68. First, he's a demagogue. He's separated people for at least 18 months during the campaign by race, ethnicity, where they worship, whether or not they're male or female, whether or not if you're female, if you're a 4 or a 10. And I'm not sure he can secure our nation and make sure our foreign policy is in America's best interest as opposed to someone else's. Now, there's a third concern that Hamilton outlined, which is objective, which is the Emoluments Clause. And that says that our president cannot profit from a foreign government while in office. So far, what we've seen from Mr. Trump is when he makes calls to foreign governments since the election, they're less about our national security and foreign policy than they are Trump Organization sales calls.
What's your political background, Mr. Supran? You're a Republican. Were you lined up for another candidate? Is this sour grapes about Donald Trump coming through as the ultimate GOP and national winner?
Well, no. Again, the Emoluments Clause is something that's been argued objectively by both Richard Painter, who was President George W. Bush.
Hello, Chris, are you there?
It's a clear objective standard that when you look at the...
We're having trouble with our line from Dallas.
...since day one. So I don't think it's sour grapes at all, but it's a decision to uphold our standards as a nation and stop us from driving off of a cliff, so to speak.
Chris, we're having a little trouble with your line, but I want to hang in there with you because this is important. How is your decision not to cast your electoral vote for Donald Trump being received by fellow Republicans in Texas?
Well, it depends on the Republican in Texas you speak to. I've gotten, of course, feedback that's very negative and very frustrating, but I've also had Republicans from across Dallas, across Texas, and across the nation who said, great job. Thanks for standing up for our nation and upholding the Constitution, taking a stand that's certainly tough instead of taking a rubber stamp approach.
So your view is that the Constitution and the writings about the Constitution of Alexander Hamilton and more require you to make an assessment beyond the assessment of the voters themselves?
Well, I definitely put a great deal of stock in the quote from Edmund Burke that was paraphrased by Lyman Hall, that a representative owes his people that he represents not only his industry, but his judgment. And he sacrifices his entire representation if he gives up his judgment to their opinion. And in this case, I think it's important that we don't elect a demagogue, somebody who threatens his critics at any turn and tries to intimidate. We've had multiple reports of other electors being intimidated and threatened regarding their political career. And that's pretty much par for the course for Mr. Trump's career.
It's interesting. There's a call for this to go on. The odds of it really changing the outcome here seem slim, but this call to principle, this call to judgment is out there. Just yesterday, you may have heard this, Chris and Kyle, this is a group called Unite for America. It's a group formed to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president, released a video featuring celebrities like actors Martin Sheen and Deborah Messing, encouraging Republican electors to vote their conscience.
You and just 36 other conscientious Republican electors can make a difference.
By voting your conscience on December 19th.
And thereby shaping the future of our nation.
I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton.
I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton.
I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton.
As you know, the Constitution gives electors the right to vote for any eligible person.
Any eligible person, no matter which party they belong to.
But it should certainly be someone you consider especially competent.
Especially competent to serve as President of the United States of America.
Chris Supran is a Republican elector. He's with us from Texas. He has said, and he's written about this publicly, that he's not going to cast his vote for Donald Trump. Do you have any hope of changing the outcome of the electoral vote, Chris? Or is this a statement, a principled stand, I guess?
Well, it's certainly a principle. I think you used the word before, odds, that the odds are stacked against us. And I'm not sure what the odds are currently. I have conversations every day and have been for several days with electors from across the nation who are interested in what I'm doing. But again, when I hear the word odds, I worry that we're talking about a gamble. Mm-hmm. I'm not putting money on a roulette wheel, and I'm not throwing dice. What I'm trying to do is make sure that we make the right decision as a nation and not an easy decision.
When in the process did you think to yourself, I can't go through with this? I can't vote along the lines of the Texas outcome?
Certainly December 4th was a little bit of a ceiling time for me when Governor Pence came out and was complaining about 3 million illegal votes, which we have no evidence of. But the fact that Mr. Trump has attacked the Constitution, he hasn't spoken out in favor of First Amendment rights. He seems to have more time to attack Saturday Night Live and the cast of Hamilton than he does to attend his own intelligence briefings. So these are all concerns that have really manifested themselves since the election and made me reconsider where I was.
You've written, and this was an essay in the New York Times, that it's your responsibility, as Alexander Hamilton laid out in Federalist 68, that the Electoral College should determine if candidates are qualified, not engaged in demagogy, and independent from foreign influence. And are you asserting that on all three, you can't go with Mr. Trump?
That is correct. Again, during the campaign, we had 50 of my colleagues in the Republican Party, all foreign policy and national security experts, who said that they thought President Trump would be a danger to America and to the world. Now, with the recent Washington Post report about the CIA, concluding that Russia was not only trying to undermine our election, but actively help Mr. Trump, I think we can say he may have been a danger to America as a candidate. Certainly, there's a lot of footage out there indicating Mr. Trump's a demagogue. He's attacked people and tried to intimidate them from his bully pulpit on stage. And again, there are many people who say he's got a clear conflict of interest. We know for decades he's played fast and loose with the financial rules surrounding his businesses. We've got no reason to suspect he'll change once he becomes president.
Who are you going to vote for on Monday, Mr. Suprin?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I know yet. I'm trying to narrow that down to a few candidates who I'm reaching out to. I'm not prepared to say, but I'm looking for, as I noted in the op-ed, someone like John Kasich with executive and leadership experience, perhaps some foreign policy or military experience that would complement their domestic capabilities. But I haven't got a name yet that I've decided. We'll announce that when it's appropriate, but I haven't made a decision.
Have you felt pressure, legal or otherwise, to stick with the Trump vote here?
Well, there's been a great deal of pressure. There's no question about that. At this point, there's been no legal pressure, and federal law, I believe, says that electors must have been decided by the 13th. So I think that issue has sailed. There's certainly been a number of people who have tried to exert pressure, telling me I have no future in politics, that my political career is over, things of that nature. And I try to remind them that when I was elected in May, I said at the time that I wasn't running for anything else. This is not a stepping stone. I've got no ambitions or aspirations for office. So the pressure they're trying to exert, I'm not sure it's working the way they intended.
What do you think of the phrase faithless elector? It gets applied here.
Yeah, it's the common phrase that's used. I like to believe I'm being faithful to the country and Constitution over a candidate. They can use whatever name they like, and I know that's the term du jour.
Chris Suprin, Republican elector in Texas, who says he will not vote for Donald Trump on Monday, though Texas went that way. Mr. Suprin, thank you very much for being with us.
Again, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Electoral College and Americans grappling with an old and controversial institution. The Electoral College votes on Monday, the real final election, then on to Congress under our system, of the President of the United States. Amid calls to end the college and some calls for electors to vote their conscience, not necessarily the way their states voted in the November election. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Do we still need the Electoral College? Is it time for it to go when the popular vote and the Electoral College vote do not go different ways? When they do go different ways, what does it leave you thinking? And do we need it, the Electoral College, to defend the voice of all 50 states, of minorities who might otherwise be rolled over? Is it time to abolish the Electoral College? Maybe to have the president directly elected by popular vote? There's a lot of pressure on electors. We just heard from Chris Suprin in Texas, Republican, who says, no, I'm not voting for Donald Trump, even though Texas went that way. Others saying, no, I'm sticking with my commitment. This is Jack Holmes. He's one of 16 electors from Michigan, a state that went for Donald Trump in the general election. Last week, he spoke to Fox News about why he's committed to voting for Mr. Trump.
I get letters, I get emails, but yet under Michigan law, I'm bound to vote for Trump or I'm deemed to have resigned. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that because I think the will of the people should be reflected in what the elector does and how the elector votes.
The will of the people reflected in what the elector does. You've got other electors saying, no, we've got to do something. This is an emergency. This is Michael Baca. He's one of the so-called Hamilton electors. They're in a long-shot bid to convince 37 Republican electors to vote for some Republican other than Donald Trump. That would leave Mr. Trump shy of the number necessary to take the presidency. Here's Colorado's Michael Baca talking with CBS in November after the election.
I think it's a break the glass in case of an emergency mechanism that we have. Hey, Donald Trump came through, but now, you know, we need to break the glass.
Break the glass. It's an emergency. Break the form. Kyle Chaney is with us, political reporter at Politico, covers the Electoral College and the electors. You can link to an excerpt of some of his reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Kyle, I want to just read a little bit from the Federalist 68. This is Alexander Hamilton, who everybody is citing lately. Of course, he wrote so early and so definitively about the purpose and the meaning of the Electoral College. This is a little long, but it's very interesting. Alexander Hamilton wrote, He said the process of election, this is through the Electoral College, affords a moral certainty that the office of president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications, talents for low intrigue, and the little arts of popularity may alone suffice to elevate a man to the first honors in a single state, but it will require other talents and of a different kind of merit to establish him in the esteem and confidence of the whole Union, or of so considerable a portion of it as would be necessary to make him a successful candidate for the distinguished office of President of the United States. Alexander Hamilton writing, of course, long ago, Kyle, that there is implicit in that that the electors would exercise judgment in their vote.
Correct, and that is what the Hamilton electors group is seizing on to say we have not just a right but a duty to be deliberative and to discuss with each other whether Donald Trump has those requisite qualifications. But the pushback you get is that that was the sort of rough outline of what made it into the Constitution. That's since been amended by the 12th Amendment, and in practice it's never been applied that way over 200-plus years of being in force.
You've got some states now that are saying, enough with this. We want to commit to following the outcome of the popular vote. We want to throw our electoral votes to the popular vote outcome, whatever that may be, regardless of what happens in our state. How many states are on board with that at this point? And
it's 10 states in the District of Columbia have signed on, and they're the equivalent of 165 electoral votes. This wouldn't have force until they reach that 270 mark, which is enough to elect the president. So they'd need a few big states to get on board to make it happen.
So this would effectively make the popular vote the means of deciding the presidency, even without a constitutional amendment that would revamp the Electoral College.
Exactly. This is sort of the circumvention of the Electoral College, a way to require states to send their electoral vote to the winner of the national popular vote without a constitutional amendment, which is very onerous and could take many years to accomplish.
I want to bring in a couple of people who are thinking a lot about this and have for a long time, where we stand right now and what ought to happen with the Electoral College. It's been a long time since it was set up. With us right now from Stanford, California, professor of history and political science at Stanford University is Jack Rakoff, constitutional studies expert. Jack, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
And with us from Louisville, Kentucky, is Gary Gregg, director of the McConnell Center, as in Mitch McConnell at the University of Louisville, political scientist there, author of Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. Gary Gregg, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be here.
Jack, you're ready to throw it overboard. Why? And is it all about this election, or is there some longer-term trend here?
Well, no, to my way of thinking, it's a longer-term trend. I first started thinking seriously about this back when I wrote a book called Original Meanings, and then especially after the election of 2000. I am a big advocate of having a national popular vote, though I would also be a big critic of the National Popular Vote Initiative that you just described. In my view, there's really only one way.
That is the state saying we'll toss it to the popular vote without a constitutional amendment. Okay.
Right. There's a big problem with that idea, which is it's very hard for me to understand how that escapes the compact clause of the Constitution, which says that compacts among the states may well require congressional approval. If you're going to have a compact that's going to affect the election of the president, which is only the single most important constitutional office we have, I just see that I don't think there's any way possible that it would escape congressional criticism. In the end, we'd wind up having to go the amendment route. So that's one argument. The other argument I think really needs to be discussed is the standard argument. What are the trade-offs between having a national popular vote where a plurality or a majority of the American people decide who will be president, and having our current state-based system? I think that's the issue we've really failed to confront directly. So it's a great question to ask. So Hillary Clinton will wind up with somewhere between, 2.8 to 3 million votes ahead of Trump. But because of the outcomes in key battleground states, she'll still lose the election. I think Americans have to ask, what is the logic of the system? Why do we have a state-based system? You can answer that in historical terms, and maybe that's something we should talk about.
Yep.
But there's still a basic question. It's a rather unusual result to say that the person who's running 2.5 to 3 million votes behind the other candidate has nonetheless won the election. Of course, we know what the obvious answer to that is, but there are other grounds, I'd say moral and democratic grounds, that make it hard to justify.
Gary Gregg in Louisville, you've been listening. You heard the Texas elector who was just with us, Republican Chris Suprin, who says though Texas went for Donald Trump, he is, as a matter of principle, not going to vote for Mr. Trump on Monday. You've studied the Electoral College. What do you make of Mr. Suprin's principled position there? Does it have merit to your eyes?
Well, I'm not here to talk too much about how they should vote, the electors. I'm more concerned with the Electoral College itself and what.
Yes, but that's what I'm asking you. He's making a stand on principle, and do you see that as justified under the Constitution?
But under the original Constitution, yes, I think you've read it brilliantly. I think too few people have bothered to look back at the Federalist 68 and to talk about it. But they did want a deliberative body that would think about who would be the best candidate for president, talk about him in their states, and then vote. So I think they're perfectly within their constitutional right to decide to vote any way they want to vote. The shocking thing about this is, and it really is, I feel like I'm in some kind of a warp here, because I've spent the last 20 years defending the Electoral College against one of the main arguments is that the left has used is an argument about faithless electors, like the crisis that will come in democracy when we have electors decide to be faithless. And now we have an established movement to try to make the electors faithless. So I'm kind of like I'm not sure where I am right now. It's a shocking moment.
Well, I think a lot of people share that feeling. I mean, we heard a little tape from one Colorado elector saying this is an emergency moment on principle. Break the glass. It's an emergency. What do you make of that, Mr. Gregg?
Yeah, well, I think that's what it's not the founders intended. It didn't intend it that way. They intended it to be deliberative from the beginning. We've democratized, but I do think it exists now, and it can exist like that in a situation where you have a real crisis, where you have some information come out after the election that changes the game and that changes the nature of the game. I don't think we've seen it yet, but we might. We may have in the next couple of days. Who knows? And so I think it can function like that. Break the glass kind of moment, and I think the electors are perfectly within their legal rights constitutionally to make those decisions.
Jack Rakoff, do you agree? Do you think there's enough on the table for electors to say, whoa, wait, we've learned, we've seen more, we can't vote the way our states voted, or is that just a huge exercise in faithlessness?
No, I disagree with Professor Gregg on a couple of grounds. First is, there's a limit to how deliberative the framers wanted the Electoral College to be. If they'd agreed that the electors should meet in one common body, like the Conclave of Cardinals meeting in Rome to select a pope, that would be one thing. But the framers provided instead precisely to avoid the danger of too much cooperation among the electors that they would just meet in their separate states. I think it's more accurate to say that the framers imagined the electors operating a bit like a primary system, that they would designate some set of candidates, up to five under the original Constitution, then three under the 12th Amendment, and that in many cases, some framers say 19 times out of 20, the election would actually wind up taking place in the House of Representatives voting by states. So there's I think the other point that needs to be made, and I think the whole problem with this Hamilton elector model is, it's a lot of it is just what historians call law office history. A lot of attention has been paid to Federalist 68.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it's really a handful of and I've paid the same attention the last few weeks. But there's only a handful of sentences. They don't really address directly the situation we find ourselves in. They neglect to explain exactly how and why the Electoral College system was created. And they also neglect to pay any attention to the way in which it operated. And one of the great ironies here, this cracks me up,
yeah,
is that no one did more to manipulate the Electoral College system as it actually began to develop in 1796 and 1800, even back in 1792, than Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was himself the great architect of trying to figure out how do you manipulate electors to do the will of a political party. So if people were better versed in history than unfortunately they are, we really understood how this institution evolved, and it did evolve very dramatically from 1796 on into the early 19th century. The idea that you could pull a few sentences out of Federal 68 and come up with some definitive notion of how the electors ought to act in this current crisis, and I agree it is potentially a crisis, that's just a zany idea. You know, if we had a better sense of history, and, you know, weren't just kind of pulling out a quotation here, a quotation there.
Well, fair enough, but, I mean, the record of how he acted and how he wrote may be different, but he wrote so persuasively. So, you know, talking about the Electoral College, he said, a small number of persons selected by their fellow citizens from the general mass will be most likely to possess the information and discernment requisite to such complicated investigations. It was also particularly desirable, he wrote, to afford as little opportunity as possible to tumult and disorder. Kyle Cheney, in the end, it doesn't seem likely that on Monday we're going to have tumult and disorder in this vote of the Electoral College, does it?
No, I think everyone has correctly categorized this or characterized this as a extreme long shot. You may get more so-called faithless electors than just Chris Suprin on the Republican side, but it doesn't seem to be heading toward that 37 number that would actually delay Trump's election.
Let's bring our listeners in. Eileen in Watertown, Massachusetts. Eileen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. So I'm very concerned about this election, and I was devastated by the news of Trump's election, but what mostly has been concerning me lately are the cabinet positions, the people he's been appointing, who are antithetical to the agencies to which he is appointing them. I would really like people to be able to find a way to persuade any electors to change their votes on Monday, and I would really like to know how people from states like Massachusetts, where I live, can have an effect on the Electoral College. The other thing I just want to add about the history of the Electoral College is that it was established at a time when there was no party system. It was a way of actually putting a check on democracy. Hamilton was afraid that the popular vote would go the wrong way and hoping that this would, Hamilton and other people who framed the Constitution, that
wanted influence.
It's a form of a check on the popular vote. But right now, we're looking at personally, I think that the Electoral College should do its job on Monday to change the winner of this election, and from then on, it should be abolished.
Wouldn't that be an incredible offense to tradition? Not the popular vote, but to, I mean, how do you just suddenly change the pattern, Eileen? Or is it required by the reality of current circumstance?
Change the pattern? You mean change the law?
Well, I mean, the Electoral College has not broken ranks. It hasn't been faithless. It's gone for the winner of the Electoral College map, even when it wasn't the popular vote that was won.
Well, Rutherford B. Hayes in 1876 won over Samuel Tilden, even though Samuel Tilden had gotten the popular vote. In 1888, Grover Cleveland won, lost to Benjamin Harrison. Those are two other cases where the popular vote lost the election, and, of course, the Gore-Bush election.
Of course.
This is the second time in 16 years where the person who won the popular vote is losing the election.
Gary Gregg, is something getting more out of kilter here? Is this sustainable if we have, you know, 2 out of 5 on average going against the popular vote in the Electoral College?
Well, let's be very clear, because it's really misleading to talk about the Clinton winning the popular vote in this. There was never a race for the popular vote. Let's be clear about that. There was never a campaign. There was never a strategy by either candidate to try to win the popular vote. If there would have been, we would have seen an election where Hillary Clinton would have been in California and Donald Trump would have been in Texas, for instance. That
fine, but it is not misleading to say that she won it. I understand how they campaigned, but she did win the popular vote.
It's misleading because it doesn't mean anything. It's just like saying, okay, let's take the football game, and instead of who scores the most points, let's give it to the winner, to whoever got the most yardage, and decide that after the game. It was a different game. And so it's misleading to think about that Hillary actually got something like the national popular will.
But here's a core conflict in perception, right? Americans want to believe they're coming out to elect a president, that they have a one person, one vote kind of influence. And under our system, they do not.
They do, but it's just counted by states. So each state is a Democratic election. It is one person, one vote. We just add the Electoral College is just an addition by states. But let me tell you, let me say if you're off kilter, I think there is an interesting point. And I think what we may be seeing more of this is because of California. California has become so overwhelmingly Democrat. Hillary Clinton won 4 million plus more votes than Trump just in California, which means Trump won the rest of the country, lost massively in California. If that continues, we're likely to see a divergence between the Electoral College and the popular vote in the future.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Electoral College and Americans grappling with this old, this controversial institution. The Electoral College votes on Monday amid calls to end the college itself and calls also for electors to this time vote their conscience. What do you think of all this? Should electors be bound to vote the way they said they would? Should Russian intervention reports or conflict of interest mean changed electoral votes? Is it time to abolish the Electoral College, to have the presidency directly elected by popular vote? Can you imagine what a recount would look like if the vote were national? And if nobody got a majority, are you ready to vote again and again? Jack Rakove is with us from Stanford University, constitutional studies expert there, has thought a lot about this. He says, let it go, the Electoral College. Gary Gregg is with us, director of the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville. He says, no, Cal Cheney is covering it all for Politico. Here's a little tape of Al Gore. Even after his loss in 2000, ultimately, in the Supreme Court, Al Gore supported the Electoral College system. But last month, on a panel in Washington, the former vice president spoke about why he no longer supports the Electoral College after the 2016 presidential election.
I think that we should go to a popular vote. I think it would stimulate public participation in the democratic process like nothing else we could possibly do. And in the internet age, having people more involved, we got to get back to harvesting the wisdom of crowds in the United States.
Harvest the wisdom of crowds here, says Al Gore, by which he means popular vote. I want to look at the background of the Electoral College and how it plays in 2016 and in the future. Callers first, Mike in Buffalo, New York. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I live in an urban area. I do not like the outcome of this election. But I also believe that the Electoral College was designed to give folks that lived in rural areas and less populated states an opportunity to kind of shock the system when things weren't working out for them and when our democratic republic wasn't working out for them. And so to that end, I don't think it should be done away with. On the other hand, we don't need to have an electoral college going and gathering and voting. You could just apportion those votes directly by the state. So since we do have real people going and gathering and commiserating, I think they should exercise their judgment and their discernment and also do what's best for our country and not necessarily vote based on how their popular vote in their particular state came across.
Boy, would you have said that in past elections, Mike? Would you have said that under in any other contest you've seen?
Yeah, I would say that for every contest. Look, our system was not designed to be a pure democracy. It was designed to be a democratic republic. And to that end, we have states that have one member of the House of Representatives but have two senators.
Yep.
For that very same reason, because we wanted to bring smaller states on board. We wanted to have less populated states to have, at times, an equal say in their government. But we also have a House of Representatives where you get apportioned seats based on your population.
Yeah, take the Dakotas. They've got that advantage of two Senate seats, even though a single member of the House there, who's North Dakota. We've had him on many times. Mike, I appreciate your call. One more right here. Tony in Macomb, Michigan. Tony, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm okay. What do you think, Tony?
Well, what I think is, for the, I understand that we didn't, that the Trump did not win the popular vote by what, 0.001% of the population.
Okay, well, it might be bigger than that a lot, but Gary Gregg says it doesn't matter. It was a different game. Still there, it stands. So what do you think?
Well, it's the rules. I mean, so now they want to change the rules after they lost the game. And I'm just dumbfounded, especially the lady from Massachusetts, to be calling for the electors to change their vote because they lost. I'm sorry. It just really irritates me. I didn't like the last 8 years of the way the country is going. I had to deal with it. I had to live with it. That's how it is.
So what about the Republican elector? You may have heard him. We had him on at the top of the hour from Texas who says, I just can't do it. Mr. Trump doesn't live up to the standards set out that I understand are my duty to follow as an elector. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I guess he should. I didn't hear his conversation, but I'm guessing he shouldn't be an elector then.
Yeah. Well, he's headed for Monday right now. Tony, we've got it. Sour grapes, you say, and these are the rules. Randy in Cardin, Indiana. Randy, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point out that just following orders is no excuse. And if you expect the electors to go up there and just be a rubber stamp, your expectations are unrealistic.
Why? This is democracy. Electors, people voted. They voted under the rules. Is that rubber stamping?
Having the rules, okay?
Yeah.
Having them set, and then you're not allowed to exercise good judgment, that's unrealistic.
And override the will of the people as expressed through the system that we've got, not a potential system in the future.
Let me ask you a question.
Yep.
Okay, now let me ask you a question. What happens if it's found that Trump knew about help or the shenanigans, let's say, from Russia, and he's in office? Now what do you do?
Well, let us pick that up. Gary Gregg, what about that? This is not hypothetical at this point, I guess. It's kind of on the table. Now, not the assertion that Trump knew exactly or not an intelligence report on that front, but certainly Russian intervention. Take it as a hypothetical then, Gary. If Mr. Trump knew and there was intervention by the Russians and he was aware of it or invited it, I don't know, is there at some point an offense to the process that would lead you to say electors jump ship?
I would say, because I do, Jack and I disagree on the founder's vision. I think we both studied it and come up to a different conclusion. Mm-hmm. But I think they really did want deliberation. They want deliberation in the states. So I think they are perfectly free right now to decide the way they want to decide on the election. I think there would be a firestorm in the country because of what we have heard. You know, it's really amazing. I don't think I've ever gone through an election. I've done this for 20 years now, mm-hmm. thinking about this and fighting, mm-hmm. where I've had anybody seriously argue that there should be faithless electors. We sort of almost always agree that's a bad idea.
Yep.
But I think it's constitutional. It's absolutely true. Your hypothetical for your caller was after he becomes president, well, then he's impeached. And that there's a remedy there that can be done. But I think they're free to do that if they think they're using their best judgment and on who should be president.
Jack, why did we end up with this system in the first place?
Tom, I'm glad you asked me that question. So my standard answer to this, it has a couple parts. The first is the reason we have the Electoral College is not because it was the most attractive option available. It's because it was the least unattractive. That's to say, there were significant objections against having either a popular election or an election by Congress. And in a certain sense, by default, we wound up with the electoral system. Second point I'd raise is in direct response to what Gary just said, which is when it came to determining who the electors would be, how they would be appointed, on what terms they would serve, the framers essentially defaulted that question to the state legislatures. It's the state legislatures who actually have the sole constitutional right of determining how presidents are to be elected. And that's what develops very rapidly once you start having contested elections, meaning when you get to 1796 and the first contest between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, then you see the act of manipulation, the electoral system, start to begin. I think, in effect, the framers defaulted the question of could you bind electors according to whatever mechanism a state decided to follow. in effect, that decision devolved onto the states. I think it's perfectly legal and fully constitutional for states to have legislation that does bind electors, that would penalize them if they don't follow the popular vote, or that would displace them if they indicated they weren't going to follow the popular vote. So that's why you really need to think about this system historically. There were critical things that the framers did not decide.
Were they afraid?
You have to trace how the system evolved.
Was it they were afraid of the popular vote? Was it that they...
No,
the
it wasn't.
Southern
it wasn't.
States, a lot of this was about slavery, right? Because it was popular vote, and slaves did not have a full vote. The Southerners would be permanently disadvantaged. With this, they're permanently, you might even say, advantaged, or were.
Right. So, clearly one concern was that if you had a national popular vote, that would be a regional disadvantage to the South. Though, interestingly, James Madison originally took that position and then changed his mind on it. But I think the deeper objection against popular election, it wasn't the fear of demagoguery. It wasn't the idea, in fact, that you could get some kind of plurality or majority following after, so controversial a figure as Trump. The real objection was that you had a highly decentralized electorate, and the framers were very uncertain whether you'd be able to identify a national candidate. If you had a popular election, you would get nowhere near a majority. And, of course, that's one of the great ironies of the system. As soon as you get to 1796, Washington announces his retirement, there were two obvious candidates, and a popular vote would have worked. In 1796, it would have worked in 1800. It works in most elections thereafter.
And here we are. At this point, what's the argument for keeping it? We heard Cokie Roberts say on NPR this week, well, it keeps smaller states in the game, and it keeps minorities in the game because they have to be wooed to win in many states. If it was a national popular election, she said, Jack, it would just be big populations on the coast that would determine the whole thing. And you'd have geographic and racial voices that were not heard.
My theory is if we had a national popular vote and we had a competitive race, the parties would discover the incentive and the means to turn out their voters wherever their voters were. So they would compete not just in battleground states, which I gather is what Gary likes. They would have to compete nationally. The means are increasingly available to enable them to do so. We live in the age of social media.
Yeah.
And secondly, if you do the arithmetic, you can't win an election just by campaigning in New York, in the Bay Area, in L.A., in Chicago, and so on. It is a big country. There are voters everywhere. A big part of Trump's success actually seems to have come from mobilizing a rural electorate that some people thought did not really exist. I agree with Al Gore. I think it would be a net public good for every citizen's vote to count. And I think the parties would discover the incentive to start maximizing turnout. I think that will contribute to the well-being of our political system.
We're talking about the Electoral College, and in 2016 in particular, they vote on Monday. Elizabeth in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. So I guess really where I'm at with this whole thing is that here in New Orleans, it went 80% to Hillary Clinton. But because we're a ruby red state, incidentally, all the electoral votes went for Donald Trump. So what happens to the voice of that 80%? There's got to be a different way to do this electoral college thing. Why can't we have one of those votes and the rest go red? There's got to be a different way to do this. Because at this point, I see people, my community members on both sides of the fence feeling like, why should I vote?
Your vote feels
Democrat.
Yeah. Your vote feels buried there in New Orleans. Our time is short, but it's a great point. Gary Gregg, how about it? Take up Elizabeth's point and let us hear your argument. You say stick with the Electoral College, but put it up against Elizabeth's concern there.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. And I think the most important thing that Jack said right in the beginning of the program was that there are trade-offs, and we need to think about the trade-offs. Elizabeth's idea of splitting up the votes among the states, I tell you what would happen in that situation is we would know how every area in the country was going to vote. I mean, we know basically every congressional district, if you divided it that way, how it's going to vote. And so you would have people permanently not feeling like they are represented. So it's not going to get us anything. What the Electoral College does get us is competitive elections. We didn't know who was going to win this election coming in. In fact, we thought it would go the other way. Potentially, Trump may have had a chance to win the popular vote, but not the Electoral College because of the great blue wall that was supposedly there. So we have competitive elections without great long legal battles. The Florida election in 2000 was a perfect example of that. It forced all of our fight down into Florida, and that's what Al Gore's forgetting now. He remembered it early on that in a close election like that, we're not counting in 186,000 precincts across the country and having legal battles in every courthouse across the land. It supports federalism, a diversity of representation. Cokie is right in that when you quote her. If you eliminate the Electoral College, you get major cities and big urban areas that already contribute most of the campaign money to candidates, so already have most of the media centered there. They will then have most of the vote. Because what Jack's not thinking, there's not enough votes to win the entire election in those, but you're going to automatically, each party is going to get 30% or so out in every place across the country, maybe the 40%. So you can afford to just take what you can get there and then run up the score in big urban areas. So we would be heading to a much more divisive country than we already are right now.
Kyle, you say it's a total long shot, not likely to happen, but if 37 electors on Monday said no to Mr. Trump, what happens, Kyle?
Well, there would be a couple of weeks of kind of a chaotic situation because it would just lead to uncertainty. Now, it goes to the House of Representatives to basically resolve the election then, and it's a Republican-controlled House, so the assumption is they may just ratify Trump's election anyway. Each state in that case gets one vote, which if you really want to talk about distorting the one-person, one-vote principle, it's that. But effectively, they would have a Republican-dominated vote there and decide who the president would be among the top three electoral vote-getters.
Jack Rakoff, do you see the country getting out of the Electoral College at some point, or is it just too gnarly, difficult?
You know, we can't get out of it if we don't talk about it. You know, there's a standard objection that constitutional change is impossible because the small states will never allow it. You know, historically, it's not clear that the small state opposition has been the key factor when the issue has been discussed in the past, and it has been discussed in the past. Now, you can make a better case. It's actually the opposition of the South on the one hand, or the idea that the South would always vote as a bloc on the other that determined this. So my position is, it's better that we talk about it and start trying to debate it than just assume that no change is possible.
Well, it's a pretty lively debate right now, and everybody watching Monday. Jack Rakoff at Stanford University, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you very much for your time and insights.
Thanks.
Gary Gregg at the McConnell Center, the University of Louisville, director there. Gary, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Great conversation.
And Kyle Chaney with Politico out of Arlington, Virginia today. Kyle, thanks for being with us.
Anytime. Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks as always for joining us, for all your comments on air and online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.